Hey, y'all, how's it going? Oh, that was up kind of loud, huh? Yeah, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. I'm sorry. It's not that I'm slacking. It's that I was typing out an email real quick. You ever wonder, whatever happened to the other Scott Horton? Well, here, he wrote a thing. If you thought it was me, you were wrong. It wasn't me. It was the other Scott Horton. Must have written this. It's his beat, after all. The unbearable lightness of being CIA general counsel. Apparently, it's really easy to be a lawyer for the CIA. The law is, do whatever you want. Grab whom you must. There is no law that can bind your authority. And if the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee gets in her way, threaten to have her staff prosecuted. The unbearable lightness of being general counsel by the other Scott Horton. Well, I just sent him an email. Maybe he'll join us on the show today and tell us what this is all about. Wouldn't that be nice? All right. Of course, on the question of the torture program and persecuting the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Oh man, I forgot to update my blog and things. Well, I was busy this morning. I didn't get a chance to prepare for the show too much. Today's going to be a lot of hot air. No, don't worry about me. I already know everything, and so I don't have to be prepared to do a show. That's not really true, but it's kind of true. Today on the show, Gareth Porter will be here, and maybe the other Scott Horton, I don't know. But Gareth's going to be here. We're going to talk more about his book. I regret I was not able to finish all of the reading that I wanted to finish today. I guess I'll have to explain to him at the start of the interview. Well, I read a chapter and a half, and then I got a little sidetracked. These things happen. He'll understand. And anyway, the chapter and a half that we're going to be discussing, why, that's a half-hour interview worth right there. No problem. No problem at all. I've been reading Gareth's new book, Manufactured Crisis. And it's about how Iran never was making nukes, and all the people who were ever accusing them of making nukes, they knew better. They're liars. Just like we've always known, but only now Gareth's written a book about it. And really proven his case, I must say. And, well, anyway, you know, I'm Gareth Porter's biggest fan. I interview him all the time because, well, his beat is debunking war party lies. They say things that aren't true, and then he proves that they're not true. And then he moves on to the next one. He's really good at it. So, that's kind of my beat, too, only I don't do the proving. I just do the hosting and let Gareth do the proving. It's a lot of fun. Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. It's got a big, evil, stinking, lying Benjamin Netanyahu on the front, pointing at his ridiculous Wile E. Coyote bomb at the UN. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu, he kind of reminds me of George Lucas. In a way that he needs somebody following him around telling him, no, dude, no, no, no. Right? All he's got is yes men. Wow, that's a good idea, boss. And he doesn't have any no men to say, no, don't get up there with the big stupid cartoon bomb. They're going to mock you. They're going to see you as beneath contempt, Mr. Prime Minister. Somebody should have warned him. You're going to end up on the cover of Gareth Porter's book, debunking your entire life. Your biggest and worst lies. Anyway, nobody warned him, so there he is, Benjamin Netanyahu. The book is Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare by Gareth Porter. And you know what? I'm glad I don't have any time to read this thing, that I'm only able to read about a chapter or so per day, because it just means real good, long, drawn-out interviews on virtually every subject brought up. I mean, I can't go back and ask him about every single paragraph he wrote, but I can try to cover pretty much everything you need to know. I know a lot of people listen to this show because they just don't feel like reading the news. Their eyes hurt when they read the news. They don't have time to read the news. They got too busy of a life to read the news. But they'll hear it on the show, though. All right, well, good. So, I'm doing my best, then, to interview Gareth in as many pieces about this book as it takes to really get the whole story through to you. And then, you know what's sort of kind of ironic, only maybe not really, is that it may be besides the point, or it may really help to drive the point home right when it matters the most. And that's my hope, that this book will help to sustain the proper attitude that is required to get the final Iran nuclear deal done. That attitude being the will of the American people and of the national security establishment and of all the hangers-on and all the wonks and whatever. They're not all going to read Gareth, but if the essence of Gareth's book is absorbed by enough of those people and enough of us regular folk, that can be enough to reinforce what apparently most of the establishment, if not the neoconservative movement, has already pretty much come to terms with, that it's more important that we get some kind of nuclear deal with Iran, that we can put this issue to bed, rather than, or that's even more important, I forgot exactly how I began that sentence, that is more important than the actual exact details of the deal. As long as they can verify plus 10, if verification is 100%, I don't know how you can go further than that, but fine. They need 110% verification that there is no nuclear weapons program, and they'll drop it as a giant outstanding issue. That's more important than stopping them from having a nuclear program at all. That's what I was going to try to say. That's more important to the American establishment now, to Barack Obama, apparently. And two, I think most of the establishment agrees with him on this now, that they want to go ahead and put this to bed, that their previous insistence on a complete suspension of all enrichment a complete abandonment of the Bushehr reactor or whatever else, I think they've recognized they're not going to get that, but that rather than continuing to use it to beat Iran over the head, they want to go ahead and put the issue to bed. But it's going to take, do you think that the neocons are going to quit? Think John Bolton's going to quit going on Fox News? You think Bill Kristol's going to stop sending out memos? And, who knows what kind of, threats they can make, too, against, people who they've compromised in power before? How would you like to get a call from Paul Wolfowitz saying, remember that time you helped me steal documents and give them to the Israeli government? Well, I can remind everybody. There's probably a few people still in power guilty of helping Paul Wolfowitz steal stuff and turn over the Israelis, right? He's certainly been under the investigation by the FBI enough times for that. Now think of how they compromised Jane Harmon. Man, that was a doozy. I don't even have time to recite that one in the 45 seconds before we go out to break here, man. But suffice to say, they got her on tape making a corrupt deal with an Israeli spy that if she would help get Rosen and Weissman off the hook for their espionage charges, they would get her a job. A foreign government would get her the job as chair of the House Intelligence Committee. It sounds like it's got to be a lie, right? Except, nuh-uh, man. Check Jeff Stein. He reported back a couple years ago. Foreign government was promising her the job as head of the House Intelligence Committee. And then the whole thing got busted. Because it happened to be... And she tried to complain, oh, the NSA was spying on me. No, they weren't. They were spying on the Israeli spy that she was guilty of being on the phone making a deal with. Anyway, point being, we've got to work for this. And I hope that Gareth Porter's book can help make the difference. I hope you will help his book make the difference, too. Manufactured crisis. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. And dang, heartbreaks always interrupting me when I'm trying to say things. Anyway, I will be so happy to see this Iran nuclear deal go through and to put this issue to bed. Not that I would ever vote for a Democrat or anything like that, but I would certainly appreciate that if these damned Democrats would go ahead and do the right thing and do this deal. And I really, you know, do hope that Gareth's book can have an effect on that. I mean, the talks start next month. The book's pretty much just new out. It's gotten great reviews, whoever's read it so far. And man, it's Gareth. The thing is absolutely meticulous, and it's not the kind of thing maybe that most people in the American foreign policy establishment want to hear, because it's mostly about how wrong they've been the whole time. But you know how, especially in the media and these think tanks, they don't care. Nobody ever makes them admit that they were wrong before. Look at that guy, Peter Beinart. I mean, I guess he said sorry for being wrong about Iraq once or twice or something. But he's able to bring up Iraq all the time and even accuse people who are wrong about Iraq of being wrong still about something without mentioning that he was one of them. For whatever reason, and Peter Beinart wrote many articles and did many guest appearances back in 02 and 03, providing that New Republic liberal consensus for starting a war and attacking Iraq back then. And nobody cares. You know why? Because they're all guilty as hell too. There's no accountability in American media whatsoever. So, or in American foreign policy, anything. They're always wrong about everything, and none of them ever get in trouble for it at all. I mean, I guess Michael Adeen got fired from the AEI, but he was no worse than any of the others. So now he's got to go slumming around with Frank Gaffney and them over at the CSP instead. Big deal. You know, it ought to be fine for anyone at any of these think tanks, especially the liberal-leaning ones, Brookings and the CFR, I guess is more centrist and whatever, but they ought to all be able to, you know, if not come right out and say, Gareth Porter rules and I'm an idiot and I've been wrong all this time and he's right and let's have peace because this nuclear thing is a manufactured crisis anyway and whatever. They don't have to say that. All they have to do is just be good on it now. All they have to do is just be informed by the book and by the discussion around the book. And they don't have to come clean. All they have to do is just start being good now. And the same thing for every member of the House and Senate, too. You know, every Democrat, there are competing incentives for certain, but every Democrat has a good reason to support this nuclear deal, to support the president on it. And that is that the president's a Democrat and he's the leader of their party. And they don't have to do what he says, but this will be his greatest achievement of his entire presidency. I know you didn't think it was Obamacare. This would be the single greatest thing he ever did. other than, you know, that time that he backed down when the American people told him to back down on trying to get us into a war in Syria. I mean, worse than he's already gotten us in over there last summer. But, you know, so every Democrat all across the country, especially all the political ones, they have a real good reason. They have good, you know, well, reasons, I don't know, good ones, powerful reasons to oppose him on this, powerful reasons to try to scotch the deal and keep Iran an enemy, such as, you know, currying favor with the Israel lobby who are trying to sabotage the deal. But at the end of the day, they're Americans, and the Democratic Party is an American party, and Barack Obama is their president. He's the leader of their party, de facto, and I guess, you know, in fact, like in de jure too, right? Officially, he's the leader of the party, even though he's not the head of the Democratic National Committee or whatever the hell, but he's the leader of the party, as they put it. And this is going to be his signature thing. Well, so what do these Democratic Congress people need? They need good arguments so that they can win in case they get attacked from the right for going along with the president on this. If they get attacked by people saying, oh, you're selling out Israel, or, oh, you're leaving America vulnerable to EMP attack because that's what Frank Gaffney said, or some nonsense, that they have the ability to shoot these things down, that they have the ability to defend themselves with the simple truth. It's not like you got to teach them a bunch of fake lines to say. All you got to teach them is the truth, right? So, I don't know. If I had a bunch of money right now, what I would be doing is I would have boxes of Gareth Porter's book on the way to my place, and then I would be putting them all in the UPS. Almost said USP, but that ain't right. You know, the big brown truck. Like DHL, only with less tattletaling. Or, you know, maybe FedEx, although I don't like the way they try to, you know, suck off of the state's credibility in their advertising there. More of a UPS guy. Anyway, I would send the books to the Congress, to all of them, to all the staff. Why not send two or three books to each, especially the Democratic members of Congress, for their staff? Hey, staff, read Gareth Porter's book and then tell your congressman what it said. Yeah, hey, it says here that this has really always just been politics. There's really not much of a threat of a nuclear weapon, and even if they did make one, or if the Martians came and gave them one or something, still, what are they going to do? Use it? They only got one? Anyway, all this can be negotiated away. Whatever outstanding issues exist between our country can be negotiated away, and we can be friends, and we can be normal countries in a normal time and have a normal relationship, just like we have with, you know, Brazil or anybody else. Well, I don't know. It's hard to name a country that's independent from us, but it's not a sock puppet dictatorship, or, you know what I mean? It's not one of our enemies, but it also isn't a satellite state. I guess Brazil is more or less independent from America these days. I don't know all about it. Anyway. We can have a normal relationship with Iran. And for people to win that fight, I think Gareth Porter's book sure would help. And this is an infomercial for Gareth's book. I mean, of course, I'd be very happy if you guys all went and bought his book, especially if you stop by scotthorton.org and click the Amazon link there first. Then I'll get a cut from Amazon's end of the deal, not yours. They won't raise your price to pay me or anything like that. As long as I'm at it here. But, you know, come on. This is why I show up and do this show every day. It ain't for all the money I'm making, because I ain't. It's so that you people will read Gareth Porter. That's the only reason I'm here. So I can tell you people to read Gareth Porter. That's the only reason I interview him. I mean, I hope that you pick up what he's putting down, but mostly what I want you to do is say, man, I need to read this guy, and then read him. That's the name of this show. The You Guys Ought to Read What Gareth Porter's Been Writing Lately show with Scott Horton. So that's why I'm going on for half an hour about it, about the Iran deal. And I really do think, and, you know, there are a few different books about Iran, but none of them are by him, except for this one. None of them completely and totally debunk all of what you need debunked about Iran's nuclear program, like Gareth Porter. So let's get these things into the hands of some think tankers. Let's get them into the hands of some House and Senate staff. Let's get them into the hands of some newspaper editors. And, of course, you know, anybody that you know in the alternative media who might benefit from taking a look at this thing. I mean, I know that you all don't, some of you may, but you don't all host foreign policy radio shows like me. Although if you listen to this one, then you're probably just about as sick of this topic as I am. But I just don't want to have to debunk the Iranian nuclear program anymore. I would like to never have to debunk the Iranian nuclear program ever again. You know how many times I've explained about the non-proliferation treaty and the additional protocols and all this crap? I'm over it, man. Enough already. Negotiate, you damn Democrats, and put this thing to bed already. You know, in 1998, Dick Cheney went to Australia and gave a speech denouncing his own president. Can you believe that? What treason to denounce his own government on foreign soil. Oh, my God. How much did the Ayatollah pay him? No, it was Halliburton. He was the CEO of Halliburton, and he went to Australia, and he gave a speech about how, man, the Iranians are people, too. Let's do business. Halliburton wants to do business with Iran, and Bill Clinton and his sorry sanctions are getting in the way. Why in the world should we have sanctions against Iran? Whatever hard feelings we have are a long time gone now. Let's do business. Now, of course, once he became the vice president and in charge of foreign policy, and was able to socialize the cost of his entire mercenary army, you know, the army and the Marine Corps, and dress them all up in the Constitution and red, white, and blue and all that crap and do things that way, then he would have rather had a war for regime change at that point, as Gareth and so many others have documented. But, you know, Halliburton, they can't afford to raise enough money for a private army from their stockholders. Voluntary exchange, private army, invasion, yeah. Regime change. That's biting off more than they could chew. They said, let's do business. Let's drop the sanctions. Let's be friends. If that's good enough for Dick Cheney ever, that's good enough for me. And only, you know, not as an argument from authority, but just because peace. He's talking about a normal relationship with Iran for whatever reason, and he's the Sith, then yeah. It seems to me that nobody could possibly be to the right of Dick Cheney on the Iran issue, right? That's just, what year Dick Cheney? That's, I say we stick with 98 Dick Cheney. Out of power Dick Cheney. Before he was ever vice president Dick Cheney. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So yeah, one of the reasons that I'm not all that prepared today is because I spent most of my morning at the dentist, spent most of my rent money at the dentist, so I wasn't able to do all the reading that I wanted to do. By the way, donate to my rent fund. ScottHorton.org/donate. And also, by the way, I think people have heard this, hey, advertise on the show clip so many times that they quit taking it so seriously anymore because they think, well, it sounds like he's got a lot of advertisers. Yeah, well, I need more of them. Like, your business, for example, or your group, or whatever it is that you're doing, I don't charge that much. I'll do a spot. It may or may not make you money. I don't know, man, but don't you think it's worth a try? You're an entrepreneurial type, aren't you? So do something entrepreneurial. Pay me to tell other people about your stuff. And then we'll check it out and see if maybe we can make a little bit of money for everybody. Right? Does that sound good? I really don't like asking for donations. I need them. I need them bad. And every once in a while when somebody sends me $100 or $200 or $300 or something, sometimes, oh man, oh, you saved my life with those. Holy crap, you don't know how bad, how much you saved my life with those. But then the 10, the 15, the $20 here and there, and plus the people who subscribe monthly, 10, 15, $20 on the monthly donations. Man, those really help a lot. But, you know, I'm a libertarian. I'm a capitalist. And I don't think everybody owes me. And I don't like asking for anything for free. It makes me feel funny. I rather just, you know, solicit ad sales. Not much of a salesman, really, but I got honesty. So, anyway, if you want to give me money, I'll give you spots on the show in return. How about that? There you go. I got to give the show away. That's just the business model. Everybody can have the show. You only pay if you want to, right? Like at the museum. All right. And also, you know, if you shop Amazon.com, this is a big deal. It could be a big deal. I really need to flog this all the damn time, but I never think to. But I should remind you guys all the time, whenever you shop at Amazon.com, just stop by ScottHorton.org first. Or in fact, you could even just bookmark ScottHorton.org/Amazon. And just click that, and it'll forward you on. And then anything you buy at Amazon after that, you know, it puts a cookie in your browser and whatever. It remembers how you got there and what code and the URL you had. And so it'll then give me a kickback from whatever you buy at Amazon. And just like in the spot, they really sell everything there. I mean, whatever, you know, any aspect of your life, right? Any sporting equipment, obviously any books, but any electronics. You need a new charger for the battery, for your camera, whatever it is in the world, they've got it. Anything they've got at Amazon.com. And in fact, even accessories for your guns. I believe that they don't sell guns and they don't sell cars. But they got everything except guns and cars, including everything for guns and cars, right? Scopes and tires, anything. I don't know if they have tires. They probably have tires. Why not? You could put tires in a box and ship them, right? They got freaking everything. I told you, a guy, this is no lie. In fact, he tweeted me and said, hey, that was me. A guy bought a range, you know, like an oven and a stove from Amazon.com. I think I made like $15 off of that one, or 30 or something. So, if you're one of those people, and you know what? There's few of you. I know that. But apparently the people who like the show really like the show. So if you really like the show and, you know, you have to spend money in your life on things that you need, well, head on over to Amazon. Buy that stuff from Amazon. And then it's sort of like you're buying it from my store because I get to make a little bit of kickback on the margin like it was my own store kind of a thing, right? So then you're helping out the show, which means that you get to have a show to listen to, and you get your stuff that you're going to buy anyway. And yes, you're buying it from a giant evil corporation, but they're giving me a kickback, so it kind of ameliorates that. And you don't have to leave your house because they'll bring your stuff to your house, even an oven. So it seems like a pretty good deal. Just go to ScottHorton.org, and there's a gigantic Amazon ad on the right-hand side. Just click that, or actually just ScottHorton.org/Amazon will forward you on in just the right way. So you can just type that in or bookmark that, and whenever you go shop at Amazon, you just go ScottHorton.org/Amazon. So, and thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, so far it doesn't amount to that much, but every little bit helps. So, I sure ain't complaining when I say it that way, that's for sure. I really appreciate it a lot. In fact, I mean, I really, really appreciate it, because that means you really got to kind of take time out of your neurons to make a little detour and stop and be thoughtful for a second and think of me and do something nice for me, like go and shop at Amazon by way of my site. That's really cool of you. Those of you who do it and will and have and shall. I appreciate that a lot. That's really cool of you. So, there. Good. I am grateful, even if I don't sound grateful enough all the time. Got hard deadlines, man. Ads coming up. All right. So let me see here. Man, I got so much to talk about. I don't want to talk about this, but I gotta. This just kills me, man. And, you know, whatever, place your bets. I don't know the answer. But it says here, how much would it cost to store all U.S. phone calls made in a year? This is by Glenn Moody at TechDirt. And what he says here is, this is from the Cheaper Than You Think department. Oh, no. We talked about the newest Snowden revelations in the Washington Post just yesterday about how a country, which, guess, Germany, Pakistan, I don't know, they said that they recorded the NSA documents, the Snowden documents, reveal that the NSA has proven their ability to record every phone call. Not sift them all for keywords live in real time and save the important ones. Save every phone call in the country and hold them for at least a month in a buffer, basically. You know, as things become a month old, they get deleted and replaced and whatever on the disk, they say. But that's a few years old. And they were already stating that their goal was to clone that exact same technology and ability all over the globe. And for all we know, you know, they have an entirely different program where they've been doing this to us all along. We don't know. But that's what these Snowden documents said, as reported by Barton Gellman at the Washington Post. And then I was talking about how, and if you're a regular listener to this show, you know I've been saying this for years and years and years and years and years, that audio file is just an audio file, and they've got basically unlimited storage capacity. And if they're not going for radio quality, but for space saving, then certainly they can reduce quality and zip these files down to teeny tiny little files and save all the phone calls. I mean, it's not like they got a cut a vinyl record. They've got to zip it down to 3 ones and a 0. No problem. And so where my part of the story breaks down is, I don't really have the technical skill. I don't really know how many terabytes or yottabytes or whatever it is that we're talking about, how much storage space that would require, anything else. Oh, well, the TechDirt steps in. TechDirt knows. TechDirt apparently has a... it's Brewster Call is the guy that they're citing here. He's got a pretty good idea of just how small they could zip those files down, apparently. And it says here, he's carried out a fascinating back-of-the-envelope calculation of how much it would cost annually to record every phone call made in the United States and store it in the cloud. Quote, these estimates show only $27 million in capital cost and $2 million in electricity and take less than 5,000 square feet of space to store and process all U.S. phone calls made in a year. The NSA seems to be spending $1.7 billion on a 100,000-square-foot data center that could easily handle this and much, much more. Therefore, money and technology would not hold back such a project. It would be held back if someone did not have the opportunity or will. And it says Call has made the calculation available as a shared document so that, you know, it's open to criticism and all of that. And he says, the writer here at TechDirt says, even if the numbers are off by a factor of two, there's still no doubt about the feasibility of recording all U.S. phone calls. And that's for sound files, which take up quite a lot of space. Not, again, not that they would have to settle for MP3. I'm sure they could zip it down into way tinier codecs than that, or whatever the hell you call it. And then text-based information pulled in from emails, web pages, blah, 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 could be stored a lot more compactly. That would make the routine recording of vast swaths of those in the U.S. and outside it, what they do online, not just plausible, but so cheap in comparison to the NSA's presumably large budget. We know it's large. They published that in the Washington Post, too. That the latter might feel it would be crazy not to do so as a matter of course. That's right. It's all in secret. It's all bound, really, by no law, as we've seen. They pretend that Section 215 of the Patriot Act covers them, but even the president's own appointed review council of sock puppet tools like Cass Sunstein said that's not true. This is a crime. Or it's certainly not allowed under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That's stretching the word relevant to mean boat. Stretching the word relevant to mean shoes. To mean something other than what we all know the word relevant means. They're just lying. But anyway, you know what? I still haven't been able to get Glenn Greenwald on the phone. I don't think that he has stated that no, they are not recording all the audio. I think that it has not quite been put to him like that yet. I still want to know. I think maybe that's what Snowden means when he says the worst is still yet to come. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, you know, I saw a tweet this morning. I almost forgot about this. I saw a tweet from Glenn Greenwald earlier about something about the prison, something. I went and I clicked on it. And what it was is a new piece at The Intercept. Here, let me find this for you, man. This is cool. Dun, dun, dun. I got The Intercept right here in my bookmarks. Here you go. The title of this article is Welcome Jordan Smith. Who's Jordan Smith, Scott Horton? Well, Jordan Smith is the best reporter, apparently formerly now, at the Austin Chronicle, which is, you know, the LA Weekly of Austin. There's a alternative once a week free newspaper in every town. They're all clones. They all got the same ads on the back. You know exactly what I'm talking about. If your town doesn't have one, then you live in a really small town. Anyway, so ours is called the Austin Chronicle. And I admit that I'm the worst at keeping up with local issues. I just don't. And when I ever read the Chronicle, which is hardly ever, I usually just read the news of the weird, maybe look at the letters to the editor or whatever. So, you know, I ain't the world's expert on this subject or anything like that. But I have read quite a bit of work by Jordan Smith in the past, and she is a great journalist. And the reason I say that is that, and I'm sure she's some kind of liberal or whatever, because that's who writes for the Chronicle, but that's all fine because the kind of work that she does, especially, this is what they say first here at the Intercept about her is the first thing that I think of, too, is her work on the case of Rodney Reed. As they say here, he is a black man sentenced to death for the murder of a white police officer's fiance in Bastrop, Texas. He was sentenced to death row despite significant proof that he may be innocent. And it was Jordan's reporting that exposed, and which has continued to expose, this evidence, which the courts have repeatedly refused to consider, still, but which has proven critical to keeping the case in the public eye. And so, now, I can't recite that whole case to you or whatever, but what I remember about reading Jordan Smith on the case of Rodney Reed is I've read a few different pieces by her on this, and they are all just, you know, Gareth Porter-level meticulous. It's just, you can tell good journalism. This is not, you know, she's not up there being a stenographer for, you know, what some jerk down at the Capitol building wants to see in the paper or whatever. She's out there cracking skulls, fighting on behalf of the powerless, on you know, against the ultimately powerful. And in this case, I mean, man, I can't cite you chapter and verse on the case, honestly. You can look it up. I mean, they have links here at The Intercept. Two different articles. One is an article. The other is like Search Chronicle for Rodney Reed. So a bunch of articles there, right? If I click on that, how many do I get? Oh, yeah. Pages and pages and pages and pages of her covering this story now. Wow. I didn't realize that she had done dozens of stories on Rodney Reed, apparently, at this point. And the deal is, it's so obvious that the cop killed his girlfriend and blamed it on the black guy. Give me a break. I mean, unless Jordan Smith is a liar, which I don't think she is. The evidence is so clear. Boy, you talk about reasonable doubt about Rodney Reed's guilt. Forget about it. Spring him tomorrow. And then it's, you know, again, I'm not chapter and verse on this case, but she is. And if you go read her stuff at the Chronicle, I think you will agree that If you were the grand jury, at least, never mind the Pettit jury, but if you were on the grand jury, you would indict this cop. Or maybe you bow down to him on your knees and kiss his feet and call him a hero and give him a handy and tell him how much you love him all day, no matter who he murders. But, you know, I mean you, not the average American. That's what the average American, I guess, would do. But you would indict this son of a bitch because he clearly murdered his fiance and blamed it on a black guy. And then, you know, this ought to be impossible, man, that the system could let such a thing happen. What about this sheriff? Isn't he worried that this might blow back on him a little bit? Apparently not. Right? Well, what about the mayor? He's not worried? Nope, he's not worried either. And the coroner? Eh. Screw you guys, said the coroner. And the judge is guilty of conspiring with the prosecutor and the cop who murdered his girlfriend to pin it on this black guy. There's no comeuppance for him. You think he's worried about it? You think he's having trouble sleeping at night because what might happen from that time that he helped the prosecution and the cops frame up an innocent man? Hell no. Not even with Jordan Smith on the case. They're not worried. They just roll right on. As they said, referred to here at The Intercept, the courts just continue to refuse to hear this stuff. Oh, yeah, that, nah, whatever. It's just like on The Simpsons. Remember that one where they're in the future and Curly is her security guy? She's the president. And he tells her, oh, you get 3 free murders. It's the same thing when you become a deputy sheriff. He had 3 free murders. In fact, the Austin Police Department APD cop, I think it was an APD cop, shot somebody yesterday. And they're claiming that he was holding a BB gun and that he wouldn't drop it. Come on. Was he pointing it at you? Who trains these cops to be such cowards? You know what? In the state of Texas, cops out there, you might come across a man with a gun in his hand. That doesn't mean he's trying to kill you or anyone else necessarily, okay? Jesus Christ, it's like you're all a bunch of housewives from Massachusetts hysterical. Oh my God, a guy with a gun! Yeah, well, maybe he's just a guy with a gun, and you need to stop crying for a minute. Jesus. The guy that they shot, he wasn't trying to kill anybody. He wasn't going after anybody. He didn't point it at the cop and threaten the cop. He's a guy with a BB pistol. Handgun. Pellet gun. And the cops shot him. Lucky he didn't kill him. The cop's such a lousy shot, he didn't kill the guy, thank God. Somebody tweeted me, said, oh, look, I guess this cop needed 2 weeks paid vacation. So he went out and shot somebody. Man, I'm really stressed out from my job, chasing people around for daring to commit offenses against the state, possibly. I need a vacation. I'm going to go shoot somebody over off a Wheelis road. I'll get away with that. Come on, let's go to Wheelis and shoot somebody. Get 2 weeks paid vacation. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent. Once I start talking about cops, man. See, to me, all of these guys killed their girlfriend and blamed it on a black guy. And all of them who didn't are guilty of being accessories to the one that did in this case, aren't they? You know, how many Elgin cops have ever arrested this cop for murdering his girlfriend? Right, none! They blamed it on the black guy. It's ridiculous. Anyway, Jordan Smith, I hardly know a thing about her, honestly. All I've ever done is just read articles by her before. It's occurred to me that I ought to interview this lady sometime, but then I never have done that. I don't know why, because I forgot, you know, I don't know. Again, I don't pay attention to local issues nearly enough. I'm from here, I love this town, but I'm more interested in foreign policy stuff, you know. But anyway, I like her because I can tell that there's real journalism in there, right? This is somebody who, you know, really does the work. And compared to most people in the journalism business, that makes her way above and beyond and badass. Even if she's wrong about some things sometimes, you know, I don't know. In fact, I guess she's the same lady that wrote all about the yogurt shop murders as well. And did a lot of good work on that story. Another big one here. But anyway, so she's working for The Intercept now. Which is so means not just for First Look, but for Greenwald's group there, right? As opposed to Taibbi's group, which is going to not be The Intercept. That's going to be a different online magazine, if you want to break it down that way. But she's working under Greenwald, I guess, or for that segment of the new First Look media. And her beat is going to be prison issues, and America is going to be better off for it. Simple as that. Our society is going to be a little bit healthier for her having access to this new nationwide audience. And by the way, I wonder, does anybody have the stats? Hey, chat room guys, do you know? Can you look it up for me? Do you know how well is The Intercept doing these days anyway? It's not quite the same as publishing all your NSA stories in The Guardian or The Washington Post or The New York Times. And I know everybody else in media hates Glenn Greenwald because he just shows them all for what tools they are. So they don't want to cover the stories he's breaking over there. But I wonder about, you know, the online world a lot of times resists what our TV bettors decide for us. So it could be that that they're doing really great, you know. I sure hope they are. I want to see The Intercept succeed. And succeed, too. Why not? I don't know. But especially succeed. They got Marcy Wheeler over there. Which is probably the best thing that they have going. I mean, that lady is just so bright. She's going to make sure they're right about everything. I don't know if they really have her fact-checking everything they write or what her role is exactly. But certainly they can't go wrong, including her in as much of what they're doing as they possibly can. They've got the Snowden documents and hundreds of more stories to come. The worst yet to come. And they've got a great lineup of writers over there, obviously, and first of all, including Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill. Laura Poitras must be coming out with her Snowden documentary sometime soon. And then Matt Taibbi, they've given him his own separate Greenwald-level magazine of his own to start over there. I mean, this bodes very well for the future of journalism in America, you know, before the clampdown. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
I'm sitting here cramming, reading Gareth's book during the break. All right, well, yeah, man, this is going to be a good interview. I just remembered that I took some notes on my phone's notepad because I didn't have my actual notepad with me for a minute. I better get those notes queued up in time for my Gareth Porter interviews coming up in just a little while. And I'm going to take my time and just, this is going to take as many interviews as it takes to get through this book, basically. That's the deal. It may be 10, it may be a couple more, it may be, I don't know. But, man, I love reading it, and you know me, I read everything that Gareth writes, and yeah, I'm learning all kinds of stuff from this book. A lot of stuff that I think, you know, later on, when I think about it in other contexts, I'm going to learn even more about, oh yeah, this was at the same time that that other thing was going on, but my neurons, they kind of need a little while to settle. But I'm telling you, I am learning a lot. Well, I mean, what do you expect? It's Gareth Porter. He's the best, man. Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. All right, now, so I guess I got to talk about Ukraine because this is an important thing. And so I'll just say the most important thing first, which is that we got to stay friends with the Russians pretty much no matter what. Because of the number H-bombs, that's all. And now, you know, I don't know, man. I guess if they invade and conquer all of Europe, we ought to threaten them that, like, you better not cross the Atlantic because we'll bomb you, dude, or something. There's a limit. But there's no reason to believe that Russia is an expansionist power. I mean, what destroyed the Soviet Union? Expansion. That fool Kennan had actually helped prop up the USSR all those years with his containment policy. And once the Vietnam War was lost, I'm plagiarizing this entire rant now from John Mueller. Once the, his book, Overblown. Once the Vietnam War ended in the complete debacle that it was, 60,000 dead Americans, somewhere between 3 and 5 million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians killed, and then the communists took over the place anyway, and Cambodia too, and Laos too. After that, the American people had what was called the Vietnam Syndrome. And so they stopped containing the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union started expanding, not outright by invading places, but expanding their obligations to prop up revolutionary governments in Latin America and Africa, and then they fell for Brzezinski's bait, apparently. Some say it's not really true. He's just trying to brag and take credit. But I think it makes sense that they deliberately started bankrolling the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in order to piss off the Russians and provoke them into invading to prop up their sock puppet commie dictator, Najibullah. And I think that's probably right. And so, in other words, the exact opposite of the containment policy, the expansion policy. Bite off more than you can chew. Tame the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, if you dare. And it didn't work. Now, if you think, everybody talks about, oh, that Putin, he's KGB. And so he's up to no good. Well, I'm with you on that. You know, he's a politician after all, but he's so smart and he's so dastardly, you know, he might have priorities like not overexpanding and biting off more than he can chew As Pat Buchanan points out all the time, I think other people know this too and talk about this some, the population in Russia is falling off by the millions per year because of low birth rates and low average age of death and mostly bad and corrupt economy that's, you know, not very healthy for the masses of people there. And it's society in a retreat right now. I mean, that doesn't mean it's all over for them. It may well mean it's all over for them. But certainly right now, they're in no position to go conquering all of Eastern Europe and all of this madness like you're hearing. And they don't think that they are either. This is not an attempt to recreate the Soviet Union. All this propaganda that you're hearing about the aggressor Russia is at least in effect a bunch of lies. At least it's a lie by omission. The real context that you must understand about Russia's moves in Ukraine, threatening to invade eastern Ukraine, not out loud, but threatening with their troop movements, and running away with Crimea as they've done. And there was an election and everything, but the context is America. Not just winning the Cold War, but completely and totally lording it over them like a bully. Just like our guest yesterday, Jack Matlock, the former American ambassador to the Soviet Union, said. America's been bullying them, kicking them while they're down. Spent the whole 1990s just liquidating, looting and liquidating and destroying all their resources. And, you know, they called it shock therapy. Like, hey, welcome to capitalism. Life's tough, but let the prices find their balance. Nuh-uh. It was all just about raping them. It was all just taking everything that was socialist owned and just destroying it. Or turning it over to very few oligarchs who just took all the money and spent it all on yachts and cokes and coke and whores and took it out of the country. Fled to America, fled to England, fled to Israel, and took all the money. Stole it all. And millions starved, really. I mean, the fall of the USSR, think about what a horrible ramshackle empire that was, and with its state-owned economy of all their industries and everything. They were, if America and everyone else had treated them with the kiddest of gloves, out of pure baby Jesus-level altruism, they still were in for a shock. Therapy or not. Their economy had severe adjustments to make. And the Americans just went and said, oh, here, let me help you up there, buddy. Bam! And kicked them in the face and stepped on their neck and kept them down. And then, so no wonder when Yeltsin came to power that he decided, no, wrong, and declared independence and kicked all the oligarchs, or the ones that weren't his buddies, out of the country, the ones that threatened the independence of Russia, kicked their asses out of the country, seized their assets and whatever. What would you expect them to do? You think that Russia, like, because magic, they're just going to have a Yeltsin after Yeltsin after Yeltsin of pliable, drunken buffoons who can be manipulated by the West into doing whatever they want? Was that likely? That was the plan? Was, well, we're just going to keep them all drunk and then we can just do whatever we want. And don't worry, we won't have a right-wing nationalist come to power and do anything about it. That couldn't possibly happen. Oh, except that then it did happen 13 years ago. It's been a little while. And yet, you know, the entire 1990s and the entire early 2000s, they've done nothing but expand NATO all the way up to and including Russia's neighbors. The Baltics. And then they talk about, I guess they're not at Belarus yet, but they talk about bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And they already have NATO-ish agreements, a NATO light, not full membership, but they have agreements with the Stans. I think all of them, Peter Beinart, I was accusing earlier on the show, wrote about this in The Atlantic, about how Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan, they all have these deals with NATO that require their, and I guess with the EU, or maybe just with NATO, anyway, or both, that require them normalizing their military equipment and strategy, which means, you know, maybe not, you know, full-fledged Poland-level welfare from America, or really welfare for Lockheed, in the guise of welfare for them and buying them all these planes and weapons or whatever they need. But, I mean, they're working on it. And so how do you think Putin feels about it? And not only that, and we didn't get to talk about this with the ambassador because he wanted to have his say about Iraq and Syria and everything else, and I didn't really want to be a jerk and interrupt him, but you know, one of the things that he talked about in there, which is really important, is that Vladimir Putin has been very good to America in the last, well, pretty much his whole time in power. You know, he and Yeltsin, they tried to object over Kosovo, but they didn't do anything about it, not really. Took the Pristina airport, although I think they were under the impression that that was within the rules at the time. But anyway, after September 11th, Putin was the first one to call Bush and say, "Hey, man, I'm here for you. Anything that I can do for you, let's kill these guys. Let's do it. You need basing rights in the stands? I will arrange that for you. No problem. In fact, how do you think our guys are being supplied in Afghanistan right now? But through Putin's goodwill to America. And, you know, on many other things, just look at how he saved America, the American people, saved us from Obama getting us into a full-fledged war with Syria, which that's a hell of a responsibility to take on their regime change in Syria. And then look at what they did to Iraq. They had to have some kind of pretend a peace for a minute to be able to leave. But they left it a complete disaster. Imagine trying to achieve that level of some kind of ceasefire in Syria. Impossible. Putin saved us from that just last summer, and here he's working with the Iranians and the Americans to get this nuke deal done. Sounds like a better president of America than Barack Obama or George W. Bush to me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right. I'm sorry. I should be more concise about what the hell. Go on too long. But Mr. Matlock, Jack Matlock, was absolutely right that Putin has been, you know, not an ally of America. America wouldn't have that, but he has done his best, it seems like, to get along with the United States. And it's the Americans who don't want any part of treating the Russian state or its leaders with any respect whatsoever. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that he took the Orange Revolution of 2004 lying down. I guess he really didn't, but he dealt with it behind the scenes. He, I think, pretty quickly bribed Timoshenko and split her off from Yushchenko, which wasn't too hard since they're both the scum of the earth anyway. And so they all betrayed each other and turned on each other and split the Western side of their politics in half. And Yanukovych ended up winning. It took till 2010. But, you know, the Russian-backed, or at least favored, candidate ended up winning again. But then for the Americans, no, you don't, man. Absolutely not. We're getting back in there again. And so they took advantage of this crisis over the EU trade deal. I think it's possible that they deliberately drummed up the crisis over the EU trade deal, so they would have an excuse to go ahead and get rid of Yanukovych. They would rather get rid of him than sign the deal with him. That's possible. I'm not certain of that. But they certainly took advantage of the failure of the trade deal, which angered a major percentage of the people. As silly as that sounds, you know, in a society where Americans couldn't care less about this trade deal or that most of the time, unless, you know, somebody really scaremongers the hell out of one or something. But for the most part, who even cares about that? But this was a real big symbolic thing, whether they were going to lean to the west or lean to the east, back toward Russia and whatever. And in western Ukraine, there was a hell of a lot of support for integrating further with Europe and moving further away from Russia. So when they came out in the street, the Americans got together and plotted a regime change. Again, maybe they already were plotting it a few steps out, you know, beforehand. But at the very least, when the protests started last November, they decided to embark on a campaign of regime change. And unmentioned in any of the TV coverage, and I don't know about all the coverage, but unmentioned in any of the TV coverage that I have seen, okay, I shouldn't say unmentioned, but virtually unmentioned, is the fact that the government that was overthrown was an elected government, and that it was overthrown. I mean, they basically just don't even cover that aspect of it. They just say, oh, you know, the new government of Ukraine, or whatever. They sort of would confuse the issue and have you believe that maybe the Western-backed guys got elected and the Eastern-backed guys didn't want to accept it. But it's the other way around. And in fact, if you look at what happened on the day that the president fled Kiev, what happened was they made a deal. He made a deal with the opposition leaders in parliament and their representatives and with the Europeans, I think, brokering the deal, that he would stay in power till December and they would have new elections, but that the opposition would be able to take over the whole parliament and all that. Immediately, the opposition broke the deal. They took their part of the deal, the control of the parliament, and they impeached him. And they had Nazi stormtroopers of the right sector and Svoboda parties, I think particularly these right sector thugs with their SS lightning bolts, they went and sacked and occupied all the government buildings. It wasn't a bunch of Occupy Kiev hippies and grandmothers. It was the right sector brutes that went and occupied all the government buildings and chased them out of town. Yanukovych had lived up to his end of the deal and called back the police. It was a putsch. It was the kind of thing where if it was the Russians who were behind this in Ukraine and it was going on like this, they would be screaming, holy hell, overthrew a democratically elected government. Just because there were some protesters outside, you sent some right-wing skinheads to seize the buildings? And call that a some kind of restoration of democracy or what? If you change the positions around, never even mind if we were talking about the Russians messing around in Canada or in Mexico right on our border, but even if we were just still talking about Ukraine. But it was Yushchenko being overthrown by the Yanukovych forces after Yushchenko had, you know, fake won. Never even mind if he really won, right? He lost in 04, and then they did a putsch and put him in power anyway. But if they had done a putsch back, oh man, the Americans would have freaked. And then pretend for a minute you believe that he actually even won the election of 04 in the first place. And think if the pro-Eastern forces had overthrown him then. Oh no, but America's interests extend to whatever they want. And Russia's interests extend to nothing legitimate whatsoever. Don't even try it. Don't even think about it. Even if Crimea has been part of Russia since 1783. With, you know, except for the time between 1950 and today, when all the time between 1950 and 1991, Ukraine belonged to the USSR, and so it didn't really matter. It only pretend to belong to Ukraine in the first place at all. The Crimean Peninsula has only belonged to Ukraine under the rules since 1992. Well, like, that's sacred? That's the sacred borders of Crimea? And then they hold a vote, a referendum, on whether they want to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. And, of course, you know, yeah, there's the hand of the Russians working in this and whatever, but our government then has the temerity to say that you can't hold an election under duress? Really? With a foreign army occupying your land? Does that remind you of anything? 2005? And not just the elections in Iraq, but I'm thinking of the elections in Lebanon. Remember in 2005, Bush said, you can't have a democratic election in Lebanon when southern Lebanon is being occupied by the Syrian army. How in the hell are you supposed to have a democratic election when there's a foreign army in your country, he said, about Lebanon. Just after they had held an election in Iraq under American occupation that installed the Iraqi National Alliance of the Dawah Party, the Supreme Islamic Council, and the Sadrists in power. That the Sunnis boycotted, and that the Americans created from scratch, right? From whole cloth. It was their election. They oversaw the writing of the Constitution, and they oversaw the election of 05. Now, I know Sistani didn't really give them a chance, but that's their fault for overthrowing the government in the first place over there, invading in the first place. But for then the Americans to say that the Crimean people can't vote because there's an occupying army there, that makes Obama sound as dumb as Bush right there. You guys are holding a pretend election in Afghanistan right now, next month, under NATO-American occupation. Who is writing the script for these guys? What the hell? They're failing terribly, it seems like to me. And so anyway, you know, I'm not in favor of the Russian state existing. I'm not in favor of the Russian state telling their troops to leave their bases in Crimea and take the rest of the peninsula. And I'm not really for elections either. I don't, you know, what if 51% of somebody wants something? I don't care. Well, you know, what are they, got some kind of magic authority over me now or something? I don't get it. But one thing I know for sure is that it's none of the American government's business, other than the fact that it's their fault in the first place and they ought to step off before they make it even worse. What the hell are they thinking? And, you know, there have been people who have asked, and I think it's a legit question. This is so obvious that when you're pushing on Ukraine and threatening the permanent, semi-permanent, basically indefinite Russian lease on the naval bases there, their only warm water port in the world, and all of that, that they're going to do something back. There are people who say this can't be the stupidity of Nuland and Pyatt, etc., which, honestly, you listen to that phone call, they sound pretty stupid and fool themselves to me. They don't sound very Machiavellian, like they're, you know, really are thinking that far ahead. But, for example, Robert Perry, who I've got my beef with, but Robert Perry suspects that what Nuland is really up to is, well, look at who she's married to, Robert Kagan. And what's Robert Kagan's interest? Treason! Robert Kagan puts Israel first. And so what good would it do for Victoria Nuland to engender such blowback in Ukraine? If you're looking for purpose in it, beyond she did not imagine that there could be consequences to her actions, if you're looking for, you know, deliberately provoked consequences, one of them could possibly be punishing Russia for working with America on Syria and Iran issues and trying to drive a wedge between their government and ours on the all-important issues of the Mujahideen war in Syria and the nuclear deal with Iran. And if they can screw that up, don't you think they'd take every chance they could possibly take to screw that up? Now, honestly, I listened to those clips of Nuland, and I think, this idiot, who hired her, and this Jeffrey Pyatt, too? Oh, they're so smug. But power doesn't just corrupt. Power makes you an idiot. None of these people. I mean, you listen to them talking about, oh, yeah, we want this guy. We want that guy. Well, the Russians, they might try to shoot it down if we do it. Whatever. But they're not talking about, hey, man, did you ever wonder what might happen if this works? That then what could be the consequences? I doubt if Victoria Nuland's smart enough to even think in that manner at all. I mean, she's dumb enough to love Robert Kagan, right? Love is dumb sometimes. Gareth Porter in a sec now. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. Thanks for bearing with me. Now it's time to talk with Gareth Porter. Gareth the Great, he's an independent historian and journalist, writes for Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net. He also writes for truthout.org. He's the author of Perils of Dominance, and then the new one is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And now this will be part four of our continuing interview series about Gareth. I want to cover everything in this book to try to, well, one, make the whole world smarter, and two, help Gareth get some books sold and all of that. And get these things out there. Get you guys interested enough that maybe you'll want to help spread them around at this extremely important time in the middle of negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. And while the interim deal reigns successfully so far, but before the final deal is inked. So we're at what here? Chapter 5, a little bit of chapter 6, something. So we got to cover Rabin, Netanyahu, and Barak, their 1990s administrations in Israel, and how and why they used the Iran nuclear program as an issue for their own political purposes. And then we can at least start to get into the history of the Bush administration. And man, there's some hilarious stuff. Just wait, guys, till you hear about some early Bush year stuff on the Iran nuclear program and the way they were handling that. It's a riot. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. Thanks very much for joining us again.
Hello again, Scott. Great to be here.
All right, good deal. So hopefully that's most of all the talking I'm going to do during today's interview right there. So let's start with, like you were saying yesterday, a couple of things. First of all, Yitzhak Rabin, who is the prime minister who was assassinated by the right-wing zealot because he did want to give up the West Bank occupation and create a Palestinian state, at least to some degree. I don't mean to say that categorically because I don't know everything about it, but he was certainly the one leaning that way more than anyone else. He helped drum up, or he decided to drum up an Iran nuclear scare in part just to divert from the fact that he was going to do the right thing when it comes to Palestine, and the Israeli people needed an enemy and they needed a distraction. Otherwise, the right wing was going to eat him for lunch, basically, and screw up his plan. So he decided he would help drum up a completely fake issue, almost out of whole cloth, against Iran's nuclear program, which is really something else. And then one more thing real quick is that we talked about how it was the Israelis' idea to do the Iran-Contra scam in the first place in the Reagan years, which just goes to show that well after the revolution and the rise of the Islamic extremist Shiite mullahs, the Israelis were perfectly happy to do business with this regime on at least some levels. And right. I'll just turn it over to you.
Well, certainly, you know, the point here is that during the 1980s, even under Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, the hard line, the period, really, of the Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Israelis had this, particularly Mossad, I would say, was the center of this thinking, really believed that this was just a temporary blip on the screen and that Iran would again revert to really being more of their ally than their enemy. certainly compared with the Sunni Arab regimes. I mean, the fundamental orientation of the Israeli intelligence and military elite is that their real enemies are the Sunni Arab regimes. I mean, that's always been the case. I think it will always be the case. The idea of Iran that they have held, particularly Mossad, for decades now, is that ultimately Iran will revert to its logical position in the geopolitical framework of the Middle East, which is that they will be at odds with primarily at odds with their Sunni Arab adversaries, and that they will necessarily have to cooperate in some fashion with Israel. So that's the geopolitical logic that has really remained the centerpiece of the thinking of many in the intelligence setup of Israel for a long time, and that's why they did indeed try to get the Reagan administration involved in the in some sort of negotiations with Iran in the hope that this would lead to something more. In fact, you know, the Israelis were supporting the Iranians against Saddam Hussein. I mean, they were not on the same side as the United States during that war, a fact that most people don't realize.
Well, and America was on both sides, at least for a time there, switching back and forth, but yeah.
Well, I mean, the Americans were, you're right, the Americans were, of course, supporting Saddam Hussein at the same time playing this Israeli game of trying to find this group that they thought would cooperate with the United States. And, of course, in the end, that proved to be a false hope.
All right, now, so you talk about in the book that when Rabin, and if you want, you can, you know, give the examples of what it was he was saying and who he was saying it to and these kinds of things, but I think you give a few different examples of him bringing up the supposed Iranian nuclear crisis at a time when his intelligence services, and including, I guess, the military, too, all had a completely different take, more like the take you were just describing, that we can work with these guys, at least for now.
It's a key point in my book that this policy that was, as I mentioned yesterday, was adopted whole by the Clinton administration, coming from the Yitzhak Rabin government in Israel in the early 1990s, was essentially based on his own political interest in, as you've correctly put it, trying to justify or make it more palatable, I guess is a better way to put it, to negotiate with the PLO, which was not a popular position in Israeli politics at that point, to say the least. And what he was doing was to create this Iranian bogeyman, which he argued, you know, unless we really protect ourselves or strengthen ourselves against the Iranian threat, then we will have much more a problem with the internal threat from the Palestinians. So we must all unite behind the anti-Iran policy here so that we can deal with our Palestinian issue. That was the way he formulated it. But really what he was doing was simply laying the groundwork politically for his policy of negotiating with the PLO.
And then, that didn't work out because he was assassinated. And so he succeeded in making an enemy out of Iran, or at least a pseudo one, but they never did give up the West Bank. He never quite got around to that before he dropped dead.
Well, look, I mean, I think it's quite clear, and I think I may have mentioned this on the previous show, that what the consequence of the Rabin hard line sort of suddenly appearing, really, in the early 1990s, I think it was really 92 when Rabin began to talk like this, just out of the blue. The consequences of this for Iranian policy were that they had to begin to take seriously the threat from Israel. I mean, before that, they were not viewing Israel as a threat to Iran. That was not the Iranian policy or the Iranian perception at all. But as a result of the Rabin policy, You know, there was talk in the early to mid 1990s of Israel. Well, we might have to attack the Iranian nuclear program because it's such a threat. And as a result of that, the Iranians then began to have to take into account the military threat from Israel, and that certainly had a major impact on the speed with which they tried to develop a longer-range ballistic missile in the 1990s, and how much money they put into it. So it definitely accelerated and made more urgent the whole idea of developing a ballistic missile deterrent. And you know, it's very clear, and I want to emphasize this, the evidence is absolutely clear that Iran's ballistic missile program was intended to be a conventional deterrent, and I don't want to go into the details about this, but the evidence is that they intended to have conventional explosives on these, and of course the missiles were not going to be accurate, so they were going to be sort of simply like a deterrent used by the Soviets and the Americans during the Cold War. You know, it was a counter-city, counter-population deterrent, but without nuclear weapons. So that is really the key point that I think people don't understand about the consequence of the Israeli policy of making Iran into an enemy, which was quite unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, of course, with the incoming Netanyahu government, and there's some variation here. You talk about how he went with a dovish approach for a minute there before switching back to hawkish. But when he switched back to hawkish, the development of these new missiles and the Russians are helping them, of course, becomes the big talking point of why it is that they have to escalate all their threats and all their insistence against the nuclear program on their end.
Right. And just that
same as always.
To go back to the initial point that you just referred to, I think this is it's really interesting to just go back and look at the starting point of Israeli policy under Prime Minister Netanyahu in 1996, when he was elected to replace the interim government after Rabin was assassinated, and. What happened is really quite significant because it again shows the dynamics of the Israeli security system, and that is that Netanyahu asked for briefings from both Mossad and the military intelligence people, and the military intelligence people at that point was represented by this hardliner who was presenting a kind of sort of threat assessment. Not dissimilar from what was being said publicly, had been said publicly by Rabin, but Mossad gave a completely different assessment, saying, "No, no, Iran is not a threat. Forget that. You know, this whole policy of presenting Iran as a threat to Israel is a bad idea. It's counterproductive, and we shouldn't be doing that." And in the end, Netanyahu sided with Mossad, and he adopted a policy of trying to reduce tensions for the first year or so. Okay, so as you said, I mean, then he changed his mind later, and we can explain why that happened.
Right. All right, I'm sorry. Let's take this short break.
Yeah.
Damn hard breaks. We'll be right back with Gareth the Great. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Go buy it right now. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got Gareth Porter on the phone. He's the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And it's so good. I'm having so much fun reading it. And I feel very lucky and fortunate that I know you well enough now, Garrett, that you'll tolerate me asking you to come on this show day after day after day to parse every bit of this, because I just love it so much. So thank you very much for joining us again. This is part four of our interview series on manufactured crisis. And up against the break there, you were talking about how Netanyahu sided with Mossad over the military, if I have that right, saying,
yep,
let's not pick a fight with Iran right now. We're talking old Netanyahu, 96. He sided with Mossad for a little while, but then he flipped and flopped. Why is that?
Well, you know, this is a bit of a mystery, and I have an interpretation which is based on, admittedly, on the circumstantial evidence. But what you see here is that it coincides, that is, Netanyahu's return to the hardline policy of sort of raising the Iran nuclear bogeyman, and I should also say the Iran ballistic missile bogeyman, coincides with the rise in American politics of the missile defense lobby, which means the people who were lobbying the Congress to have a national missile defense program in the United States. And they had a huge amount of money behind them, and they were sort of mowing down opposition in Congress and prevailing in 1996, 96 to early 97, to the point where the Clinton administration was feeling a bit really intimidated politically by the power that they were showing. And it was, over the next couple of years, that power was so great that I show in the book how the CIA essentially bowed down to the power of the missile defense lobby in Congress by reversing its position on this issue of what the Rumsfeld Commission had had eventually come up with as a the idea of a threat of an ICBM program that Iran and North Korea could mount over a period of 10 to 15 years.
And this Rumsfeld Commission, this was another Team B exercise, basically,
exactly,
outside of the Clinton administration.
Absolutely. And it was, of course, completely dominated by and oriented towards the interests of the missile defense lobby. It was a shabby piece of lobbying by the folks who were going to profit from it. The four major defense lobbyists were well-placed within the staff, and they were allowed to basically do the work that was cited by the commission to justify their position that Iran and North Korea could, they didn't say would, but could come up with an ICBM in a few years. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that that there was this new major development in the politics of defense policy in the United States, which you know, looked to the Netanyahu folks like a major opportunity for Israel to cash in here and make the argument that look, the Iranian missile program is being pushed forward by assistance from Russia, from the Russian government, and the United States should really clamp down on the Russians here and prevent the Iranian missile program from advancing any further, because otherwise the missile program will be able to threaten Israel, and ultimately they'll threaten the United States with their ICBM. So that's exactly what happened. Netanyahu switched his position and started beating the drum on the Iranian threat, both on missiles as well as on the nuclear program. And from 1997 on, from late 97 on, he took the old extreme position of the same one as Yitzhak Rabin, that Iran was a mortal threat, an existential threat to Israel. So that was really the beginning of the Likud policy, which they've continued ever since.
All right, now hold right there for a second, because I want to get back to something that you wrote here about the position of the Israeli government as far as, you know, their accusations and threats, et cetera, about Iran's nuclear program and their missile programs, et cetera, as it relates to the Palestinian issue. We already talked about how Yitzhak Rabin needed to distract people from the fact that he wanted to do the right thing and make peace in Palestine. But you write about Netanyahu, and you quote Keith Weissman, the former indicted for espionage AIPAC official, yep. Iran expert, talking about this as well. And his point basically was that Netanyahu did not want to distract from the Palestinian issue. He wanted exactly. the Palestinian issue up front and center, and over his dead body, was he going to give up the West Bank or you know, make any kind of peace deal with the Fatah or the PLO there or whatever. And so he thought that his position on the West Bank would be firmer if he would stop distracting everybody with the Iran issue and focus on just what a mean SOB he is when it comes to occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
That's right. That was his initial take on the linkage or relationship between those two issues.
But then the missile defense money was just too good, I guess.
But what's interesting, though, and I'm not sure that I actually referred to this in the book. I think I had an initial draft and I had to cut it out because of space problems. But more recently, you see, and I mean by that, 2012, 2013, if I remember correctly, you see Netanyahu making the argument that their Palestinian problem is really an Iranian problem, because, you know, what is the where does the threat come from to Israel now? It's coming from Gaza, and Gaza is Iran. Iran really mm-hmm. controls Hamas, and Hamas controls Gaza, so that's where the threat really is. So he managed to find a way to link his position on the Palestinian issue with his position on Iran.
Right. Well, and he'll link it to anything, and then it's always the other issue first, then Palestine, but it's never Palestine.
It's never Palestine in the sense that there has to be some real serious effort to make concessions to the Palestinians, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and that really has to do, of course, a lot with, his current government's policy always. Whenever anybody says Palestine, he yells Iran. So
yeah.
it serves his ends all the way around. He gets to implicate the Palestinians for receiving support from Iran, but he also gets to distract the people from the Palestinian issue and I don't know how it is in Israeli popular opinion. It sounds like in the 90s he really wanted to rally everyone around the fact of how wrong he is about the occupation. It sounds like now he would just as soon distract the Israelis as the Americans.
Yeah, I mean, you could call it a distraction, and at the same time, it's an effort to sort of build support for his policy, his hard line on the Palestinian issue by combining it with Iran. At the same time, trying to build support for his right. Iranian policy by combining it with Palestine. So it's kind of a linkage which he is at least hoping is going to strengthen his position on both sides
right.
in terms of the Israeli public opinion.
All right, now if you could, I think it would be instructive for people. As long as we have no real deadline on getting this book wrapped up here, Gareth, if you could get into some of the details, just give us some examples of the kind of hype that was coming out about Russia and Iran and the advances on their missile systems and whatever,
right.
and how that was used. Well, you already explained how that was used, for the threatening policy. But could you go through and explain just how wrong it all was? Because you do a great job in the book of bringing up example after example of they said this, but then the truth was really much different.
Well, the key, the single biggest piece of alleged intelligence that the Israelis used to try to make the case that Russia was really the key to the Iranian missile program and that the Russians were deliberately helping the Iranians to increase the range of their missiles and to make it possible for those missiles to reach Israel was that they were arguing, the Israelis were asserting that they had an actual contract that a Russian energy firm had signed with the Iranians that would give the Iranians actually the technology that was used for the Iranian for the Russian long-range missile that that had been used in the 1980s, as I recall, 1970s, 1980s, an older Russian missile, and that this technology was crucial to a new advanced missile that the Iranians were developing. Well, it turned out that contract did nothing of the sort. It did not involve this special technology that had to do with the advanced Russian missile, and indeed the company that supposedly signed the contract was not even a contractor. It was not even involved in the development of the Russian missile. So it was all complete fiction. It was the usual Israeli flimflam that was used to convince. I mean, they leaked this stuff to the American press, of course, mostly to, not mostly, but particularly to the Washington Times. The right-wing Washington Times was their favorite target. But they also leaked it to various other news outlets, and the story basically took off, and it became the news media narrative around this question of the Iranian missile program, that the Russians were deliberately helping the Iranians to reach Israel on their missile program, and later it became, I think, it was pretty much proven that this was all complete hype. That the Russians, that at best there were only marginal technology advances that were due to Russian assistance or Russian technology, Russian engineers who were working with the Iranians. In fact, one of the people that was quoted in the Washington Post study of this that I have in the book shows that it's likely that the Iranians were actually trying to create the impression that they had these high-level Russian engineers who were helping them on the missile program as a deterrent to try to convince the Israelis that they were much more advanced in their missile program than they really were. Yeah. In fact, these were very low-level engineers who didn't have any inside high-level technology advances for them at all.
Yeah. Well, and again, I guess... Well, and all right, so we're over time. Virtually, I guess this is really the theme of the whole book, is that they never really were making nukes, but as bad as it ever got, and as good as their missiles ever got, and as many centrifuges as they've ever spun, it's all blowback from all the stupid mistakes of the American and Israeli chickens who started this chicken egg thing. I mean, there's really no question. You talk about, you kind of wrap up the 90s era with the Iranians deciding, well, geez, I guess this is, with the Iranians deciding that, geez, I guess the Israelis really are enemies, and we got to really, you know, change our strategy for dealing with them. They're not going to let this go. And, you know, you really do a pretty good job of showing in the book about how their decisions about, you know, how to go ahead and escalate their commitment to the nuclear path that they're on always come down to, you know, these kinds of, you know, basically provocations from the West, from the short-sighted ham-handedness of the Western powers here.
Just
or
to
if
be
you count Israel as a West, you know what I mean.
To be specific, in 1997-98, you had Netanyahu starting to talk, not to talk openly, but to use various indirect ways of getting out the message that Israel might have to attack Iran's nuclear program and missile program. So this was, of course, a spur once again to Iran to speed up its development of a longer range missile to be able to deter Israel. That they were clearly responding to very direct threat from Israel, which again was completely unnecessary.
All right. Now, I guess tomorrow we'll pick up, assuming you're available tomorrow afternoon to talk about this some more. we can really pick up with the incoming Bush Jr. administration and the neoconservatives and their approach. And that's going to begin with the great punchline, too. I just love this part of the story. But just to make
sure. We're getting to the heart of the book there.
Yeah, yeah. Good times. These neocons are just a riot, man. I don't want to spoil it, but it's going to be hilarious. Well, I don't want to build it up too much either. It's worth the chuckle. Here's my question to wrap up for today. We're already over time here, and I'll let you go. But is there anything that we need to know specifically you think we're taking the time to mention about Ehud Barak and Ariel Sharon and their policies after Netanyahu left power, any specific changes they made leading up to the era of George W. Bush, where we'll pick up tomorrow?
Well, if we're talking about Sharon specifically, there's no question. I mean, he was he overlaps with of course the Bush administration. He was still there in 2002, 2003, and that's when some very crucial things were happening. 2003, 2004.
What about Barak when he was in power? I mean, he was in power for quite a while, right?
Yeah. I mean, Barak represented sort of the return to the initial labor policy, no question about it. I mean, he was beating the drum, just as Rabin had beaten the drum for the threat from Iran. Even though, as I point out in my book, a Mossad gave a briefing to the foreign minister of Barak. I think it was in 1999, if I remember correctly, that emphasized that. That Iran was not an urgent threat. That there were still reasons to take a much more a less urgent approach, and this was a briefing that again simply did not support the kind of policy that was being announced publicly that was being taken publicly by Ehud Barak. It was just a huge disparity between the public position and the actual intelligence underlying the government's policy.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the one time in the book so far where the intelligence agencies are saying anything hawkish, it's just the IDF, and when the Mossad contradicts them, Netanyahu sides with Mossad in contradicting them. The rest of the time, the politicians are always way out ahead of the intelligence agencies on their accusations, and even the need to have a confrontational attitude toward Iran at all.
That's correct. Absolutely. I agree with that way of summarizing it. Yep.
That sucks. All right, your book is so great. I love it. I'm so glad that you wrote this thing, Gareth. And
thanks so much. I really appreciate your plaudits. That's really good to hear. Thanks.
Well, yeah, and believe me, I really am grateful that you're willing to spend this much time on the show, answering my oftentimes half-baked questions.
It's my pleasure. Clearly, I mean, I'm glad to have the opportunity to go into such detail. Thanks.
Okay, great. So 4:30 tomorrow.
Yep.
All right, great. Talk to you then. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye, Scott.